These frontier models are allowing us to build amazing applications, but they need a lot of workflows around them. Just themselves is not sufficient. They're the reasoning engines, but in order to build an actual car, you don't just need the motor, right? Like, you actually have to build a lot of other things and package it and sell it to the end user.
Welcome to Ask More of AI, the podcast looking at the intersection of AI and business. I'm Clara Shai, CEO of Salesforce AI, and I'm thrilled to sit down today with three amazing entrepreneurs in the AI space. Arvind Srinivas, co-founder and CEO of Perplexity AI, Jerry Liu, co-founder and CEO of Llama Index, and Harrison Chase, co-founder and CEO of LangChain. Arvind, Harrison, Jerry, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having us here.
Thanks for having us.
Excited to be here.
So we've got a diverse set of listeners and viewers out there, and maybe we could start off by level setting what each of your company does, because they're very different. But one thing in common is that each of your company, in your own way, is making large language models better and more usable for developers and for customers. And I think that's just fascinating. So Arvind, maybe we'll start with you.
Yeah.
You are the founder and CEO of Perplexity AI. Tell us what Perplexity does and how you're expanding from the consumer space now to the business segment.
Yeah, so Perplexity is an answer engine that just directly answers your questions. It's meant to change the search paradigm to moving people from links to answers, except the answers are still supported with references in the form of citations at the end of every sentence. We think that a lot of people's day-to-day searches that were typically done on traditional search engines involve deeper research that would best be catered in this new interface. That doesn't mean the traditional search engines are going to die, but they're going to be more of a navigational tool in future. And for actual questions, you would prefer a tool that just gives you back an answer. And obviously, we started off without any particular user segment in mind, because the magic of all Gen AI products lies in the generality. And the more you start fine-tuning it for one domain, it's hard to retain the generality. And then we got to observe the query patterns, the categories, who are using it, and slowly focused on trying to help the narrower segments better through user workflows. Our pro plans enable that targeted knowledge workers, and even knowledge workers is a huge category. So step by step, we'll try to get it adopted in more enterprises.
And how many users are there right now in Perplexity?
Totally, we have tens of millions in user category. But we don't actually track users as much as number of queries a day, which is our North Star metric. And I can tell you why. The only metric, you got to always pick a North Star metric for your company that is aligned with long-term progress. Number of queries a day is the only way we establish a data flywheel and can go back, identify mistakes, and fine-tune the models or change the way we index certain domains or subdomains. And, whatever increases the number of pages in our index or the quality of our models, user downloads, which we collect to improve the error rates and things like that, is what will make your product continually better. You could have some users who just come and don't really do many queries at all. And that might artificially make you feel you're having a lot of progress. But if that doesn't translate to actual usage, it doesn't matter.
So you want to set a higher bar.
Yeah. And this is the metric that Google's used to for ever since their beginning. They never really cared about the number of users as much as the number of daily queries.
So you're taking on Google, and instead of having to do a bunch of searches and refinements and clicking on links, users can just get their answers directly from Perplexity.
Yeah, I wouldn't say we're taking on Google. It's more that we're creating a new category for answer bots, assistants that can just directly answer your questions and do your research for you and give you back high-quality answers. And then go even a step beyond that. Take the answer. What do you do with the answer? How do you do even more complex research queries, and so on? So we want to be the ultimate research buddy or the knowledge buddy for everybody in the planet.
Okay, Harrison, LangChain, tell us what you do.
Yeah, absolutely. So at LangChain, we build developer tools to help developers build applications powered by LLMs that reason. And so what I mean by that is we see a lot of the applications that people building use an LLM as some sort of reasoning engine and connect it to external sources of data and computation. And so we build developer tools to help make that as easy as possible.
And one of the key aspects of this is that LLMs, they're non-deterministic, and developers want more control. And so you help them chain together different logic. Do you want to, what would inspire that idea?
Yeah, I mean, so LangChain started as a side project like a year and a half ago. And I think the name LangChain comes from the idea of language models, Lang, and then chain, and just the idea of using them as one part of a larger system. And it could be multiple LLM calls together. It could be a retrieval step and then an LLM call. One of the really cool things is, you know, we just see so many different combinations because I think it's still super early on in the space and people are exploring so much. LangChain comes from this idea of language models, combination of things, to the point around kind of like the unreliability or stochastic nature of these LLMs. Another big thing that we're working on is LangSmith, which is kind of like our developer platform for more observability, testing, evaluation. We're starting to do things more in like online monitoring and eval now. And I think this, we view this as really important because we view the LLMs as a crucial part of these systems. But even just understanding, like, by the time you've assembled all this context from various sources, what exactly is going into the LLM? What exactly is coming out? What's the next step in the sequence? If the sequence itself is kind of random, all that stuff is really important to understand and really help make your applications better. And so that's an exciting direction that we've been spending more and more time in recently.
That's awesome. Jerry, tell us about Llama Index and what inspired the idea for that.
Yeah, so ever since we started, the core mission of Llama Index is to enable any developers to build LLM applications on top of their own private sources of data. If you think about the vast amounts of data within either an enterprise organization or, you know, just personalized to an individual, you know, there's all this unstructured, semi-structured, structured data. And especially when we were playing around with like ChatGPT in the very beginning, you know, it was clear that these models were not only really good at generating things and memorizing pieces of knowledge, but actually about reasoning over new pieces of information and synthesizing new insights as well as taking actions. And so our motivation was, how do you actually take all these reasoning capabilities and basically leverage that on top of all the vast sources of data that you have? And so we have two components within the company. One is a pretty popular open source framework that enables people to build applications over their data. A very popular concept these days is this idea of retrieval augmented generation, where basically you're able to stitch together some data along with a language model to build like a ChatGPT-like interface over your data. And then we also have an enterprise platform that's specifically focused on getting you clean quality data for your LLMs. And it turns out there's this like new data stack that's emerging to make these context augmented applications possible. And our managed service, or we call it Llama Cloud, enables developers within all these different organizations to do that.
So there's this debate right now around, you know, when do you use RAG versus when do you have to fine tune? Based on all the experiments that you're constantly running, what are you all seeing?
They are more connected to developers, but based on our own experience so far, I kind of see this as like when you want to add new knowledge to your model, you probably want to rely more on like doing the RAG part really well. That is, don't try to make the model memorize new facts. Decouple facts and from reasoning. And like the word he used is pretty apt. Like, think of LLMs as a reasoning engine, and think of the facts as the retrieval engine. And together, you're combining them together to build a knowledge engine for your enterprise or for your users. So when you want to add new facts, try to use the retrieval engine as much as you can. And when you want to make the model respond in a certain way, like improve its formatting, improve its ability to handle conflicting facts, when there are like two documents saying the same, talking about the same thing but presenting different information, that is what is called as a skill, or the ability to reason, or the ability to transform unstructured text into like structured format like Markdown or JSON. Like these are the things that you want to train the models for, and anything else you want to keep as much as possible in the retrieval engine.
So, and you would know a thing or two about this, because prior to Perplexity, tell everyone about your background.
Yeah, I mean, like I'm an AI researcher by training. I've written a lot of papers in transformers, unsupervised learning, and things like that. So obviously when those days, like AI was not obviously as hot as this, like, you know, NeurIPS was still attended by researchers more than VCs. So it's completely flipped over now. But one thing was clear, that like people were, that the moment that I would say a lot of people don't remember this. BERT was the first big moment for AI to like transcend into industries, especially NLP. So Transformers was there and GPT-1 was there, but BERT was the time that it got like very serious. And then GPT-2, GPT-3, that's when GPT-3 was when like you don't even have to do a lot of machine learning. Like the new discipline called prompt engineering began, and like people were able to program these things to do tasks for them rather than like collecting a lot of data and training models. But it was still not reliable enough to become an industry level impact, like people actually building products with it and getting into the hands of users. So there's always like, you know, there's this whole talk of emergence, like this ability, this emerges by scaling. But reality is it's always gradual. You can track it on in terms of metrics. But the thing that's actually emergent is reliability. When the metrics get to a certain stage, like say it's 5% in GPT-3 and then it suddenly gets like 60% in GPT-3.5, 80% in GPT-4, and 80% is when it's like reliable enough to put it into products. So that is emergent now. But the metrics are gradually always been increasing with more scale. So that's what we're beginning to see. Like GPT-4 is so good, Claude 3 is so good. These frontier models are allowing us to build amazing applications, but they need a lot of workflows around them. Just themselves is not sufficient. They're the reasoning engines, but in order to build an actual car, you don't just need the motor, right? Like you actually have to build a lot of other things and package it and sell it to the end user.
So and that's, hence the value each of you in very different exactly. ways can
provide. We are building a product. Like these guys are building the developer tooling to help other people build products. So there's a lot of value we can create through this process.
Isn't that really hard, though, when the underlying substrate, in this case, the models themselves, are changing so fast? It's like the moment you build tooling that is optimized for one, then you have to switch it out. How are you managing in that in this landscape?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is, definitely one of the hardest parts. Just short anecdote about this. The original model that we were using as part of LangChain when we launched was deprecated by OpenAI a few months ago.
How so annoying.
You literally cannot use that. Yeah.
DaVinci.
Yeah. And so, yeah, I think it's something that we've tried to balance. We went over a year without kind of like a stable release of LangChain, and we just released a stable release a few months ago. And part of that was very consciously we thought the underlying models were changing pretty rapidly.
For people who don't know, what is a stable release?
We're not going to make breaking changes. When we move on to a new version, we're going to maintain bug fixes for the previous release. And so we're basically saying, like, you know, we think the abstractions here are solid. Like we're gonna roll with this for a while. But until then, you know, I think we did do a pretty good job of maintaining backwards compatibility, but there was a lot of changes, like chat messages versus string in, string out. Like that was a huge change to a lot of the underlying kind of like abstractions that we had. Multimodal, we were waiting for multimodal before kind of like doing any stable release. Luckily, it wasn't that huge of a change. I think at least in terms of the APIs, they remained relatively stable. But yeah, I mean, that's one of the things that definitely keeps me up is just how, because we don't train our own models. We use other people's models. And so if they release new APIs, new ways of thinking about things, that's absolutely going to have a huge impact on our frameworks and what we do.
And maybe as part of the value you can provide to developers, right, to help them, you know, maintain that abstraction while you figure out the connection to the new models.
Help them maintain it, help make it standard across model providers as well.
And actually, to Harrison's point, I actually think that's one of the values of having an open source project. And I actually argue that makes you iterate a lot more quickly than if you had like a fully built out product feature and then all of a sudden some underlying model change and there's a new use case. It takes a lot longer in terms of edge time to actually productize that new feature versus just like at least having some core abstractions and then core capabilities to enable other developers to build with it. And I think that's one of the nice things about open source is it is a lot of work on like our engineering teams basically to try to maintain these interfaces. But because you're able to iterate on it very quickly, like let's say GPT-5 comes out or, you know, like Claude 4 comes out, right? And you're able to iterate on those interfaces a lot more quickly than shipping a full-blown product. And so as a result, this kind of speaks to the broader point that I think a lot of Gen AI adoption within the enterprise right now is developer-led. And I think the reason for that is because developers have access to the right set of tools to rapidly iterate and prototype these new features, right? As opposed to building something and then like throwing it away every few months.
So it's interesting. None of you has your own model right now. Is that something that might be in the cards down the road? You've built models before, but you've consciously chosen to not in this particular case. What's the reason behind that, and would that change down the road?
So we don't have our own foundation model, but we have a lot of custom fine tunes of them already being served in the product, built on top of Gemma or Llama, Mistral. So we're always like tracking all these open source LLMs and customizing them to be good at our product use case. So the free version of the product largely uses a lot of our own models, actually. The paid version gives people the access to other frontier models that are better than the models that we have, which includes like GPT-4, Claude 3 Sonnet, Claude 3 Opus, and Mistral Large and things like that. A conscious decision we made after we raised our Series A funding was not to allocate it on a GPU cluster and go train our own foundation model. This was probably one of the best decisions I made, but we made a bet that there will be good open source models that rival 3.5, and also that 3.5 will become a lot cheaper and faster, and then the chips will become faster and cheaper, allow you to serve products with like few inference nodes rather than a lot. So we made these bets, and that all turned out to be true. Like H100s are like way more efficient for serving models than A100s. So you can serve a whole product for like millions of users and like just a few tens of GPUs. All these things changed, you know, compared like beginning of last year, all these things were unclear. Now they're like a lot clearer.
That was the right call.
Yeah. So I in general, I feel like if you are a product focused company, don't invest too much in foundation model training, that is training the base model, unless there's like real incentives for you.
So you fine-tuned Llama 2 in this case.
Yeah.
At what point do you say, okay, well, Llama 3 comes out suddenly mm-hmm. later this year, for yeah. example, mm-hmm. and then do you have to start over?
No. That's the amazing thing about having all the post-training expertise. Post-training is just a fancy way to call fine-tuning when you're actually doing it on a lot of data. But let's just say, typically fine-tuning is a word you use for like throwing hundreds of thousands of examples, not a lot. But post-training is when like you take a base model and you do the SFT and RLHF yourself, the supervised fine-tuning step and the RLHF, reinforcement learning from human feedback. And when people release both the base models and the chat models, you can take the base model and custom post-train it with your own SFT and RLHF stack. And that's very useful. And that's what you can do to differentiate your models from the other chat models on the market. These are all the things that you would do the post-training for. And this expertise is very useful no matter what base model you start with.
And that's becoming your secret sauce.
Yeah, we want to be world-class at it. And that doesn't require a lot of GPUs. You don't need like tens of thousands. You only need like hundreds or maybe thousands. But what you actually need is a good team of people who know what they're doing here, because it's so easy to get things wrong even here. And it's so easy to get things wrong further in the pre-training world also, except mistakes are like tens of millions of dollars costly there, whereas here it's more like a few hundreds of thousands of dollars so you can afford it.
What are the pitfalls when people are fine-tuning?
A lot of the pitfalls are like, let's say you're going out and fixing a certain issue. Like you have a model, you find it to be too verbose. And so you now like are training on a new data set that has shorter responses. Now what happens is, it's just too concise even for an actual question that requires, or like give me a short explanation of a phenomenon, it just responds in a single sentence. And then you go back and collect another data set that has like longer responses. Now it starts being too verbose for no reason. So how do you handle like different types of queries that require different types of responses? And then like how do you handle things like you know, stochasticity? Sometimes like the same question, same prompt, might get you different completions because the model was just not calibrated well enough. And these are the sort of problems that can only be addressed with good RLHF, like pure SFT doesn't get you the sort of a model that's very deterministic. And so you need to have the right balance. And like RLHF particularly is very sensitive to the data set you train on. So if you get that wrong, it can go, it can make the product a lot worse. And evals is actually like one of the biggest problems. Like if you don't have good evals, you might think you got a good data set and you're trained on it and you can just deploy to production. But if you don't track the evals correctly, if that is basically evals is a proxy to saying, can I just replace the earlier model with this new fine tune?
I think Harrison might have a product for you.
Well, I was going to ask, how do you guys currently do evals?
Yeah, we track like three different dimensions: accuracy, readability, and obviously the latency. So latency is decided not by like the actual data you train on, just like your serving infrastructure and like the number of parameters of the model. But accuracy, like factual accuracy and like how readable it is, how well it's formatted. So we have a team of human contractors who constantly rate different completions from our own models and other models and rank them. And then we use that to like further go and collect another data set that can get us better on the queries that we're not doing well. So it's an iterative process.
Super interesting. One question I have for you as well, Arvind, since I think he's actually building products, we're just building tools, so I think he can actually speak to what people are doing in practice. But how do you think about few-shot prompting? Because this is something I've seen a bunch of buzz about recently, and for those of you who don't know, few-shot prompting is you include a few examples in the prompt itself.
Yeah. So obviously, when you're including a lot in the prompt, you have to be aware that the more you throw into the prompt, the more latency you incur, and like the more you like let go of context, especially as people are engaging in like longer turns in the conversation, right? We use few-shot prompting for collecting data sets and stuff. Like, let's say you want to just build a small classification data set and then train a custom model on that. So when you're deploying a product, it's not just a summarization model, right? Like, you're taking a query, you're reformulating it, you're classifying it, and you got to do all these things to be able to respond in like different UIs for different queries. So these require you to go and collect some data sets that use a larger model as a teacher. And for all those sorts of things, like, you can use few-shot prompting to benefit a lot. Another place where few-shot prompting can be very useful is like when you're collecting a data set for RLHF, you want like different completions from the model. And in order to extract different completions, just changing the temperature is a pretty hacky way of doing that. Some more like, better hacks, I would say, I wouldn't call it principle, is just having different few-shot prompts and eliciting different completions as a result, and then using that as the ranking completions for the teacher, so your in-house LLM contractor or something. So there are like many creative ways to do all these things.
Super interesting. And out of curiosity, when I go to perplexity.com and I type something in, how many LLM calls are getting made to respond?
I genuinely don't know. Not to be cagey about it, but I'm not like up to date with all our backend anymore.
Yeah.
But I'm sure there are like at least, definitely more than 5 or 6.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, all those asynchronous calls are what, you know, people keep like, why are you a wrapper and things like that. But being a good wrapper takes like really good orchestration abilities to like handle all these asynchronous calls simultaneously and still serve a really fast product at the hands of the consumer, right? And that's also the value these guys are adding, because not everyone can do this. So that means there are companies that would not know how to do this, or like would take them many months to figure out. And instead, they can rely on the tooling that they build and can benefit from all of that, and rather than having to figure out everything themselves.
That's right. So, I mean, both of you work with a lot of developers. What kinds of trends are you seeing in terms of model usage and, you know, most sought after use cases? What are you seeing? And is there anything that's surprising?
Yeah, I mean, I think for us, just given the nature of the framework as well as the company, I think we've seen a lot of use cases around RAG, like retrieval augmented generation. And specifically, you know, like last year was really just people were prototyping some simple chatbots over their data. Now it's like still roughly chatbots, but like there's more data, it's more complicated, and you have to figure out how to like productionize this whole thing. And so it gets a little bit more interesting. I think a core use case that we see a lot of different enterprises is similar to what I described in the mission, actually. You have like, you know, some SQL database that's like operational data. You have like 1,000 to like 1,000,000 PDFs somewhere like locked up. And you just want to understand it and basically surface insights. And the reason this is valuable is because your end users, this really like unlocks a lot of like efficiency for your end users, because then they don't have to go in and dig through all this knowledge, like go open up like Acrobat and actually read through all this information. And so I think this is something that, to be honest, I feel like there's a base layer of applications are starting to move past this. But like even like once you start to productionize this, it actually is pretty hard to do. And the thing that everybody cares about, especially when you try to make this thing work really well, is response quality, right? And so response quality, where given any type of question you want to ask, you're able to get back an actual answer. And, you know, this is where evaluations are important, for instance. Like, you want to make sure you have proper metrics to actually track response quality, to measure it, and to be able to iterate on that. This is also where having, like, a proper data stack is also important, because you want a proper way to actually process all your input data, make sure that you're basically, you know, able to propagate updates, especially if that data is outdated, and then you're able to represent all that data somewhere in your storage system, you know, somewhere in your data warehouse or data lake, so that you can surface it to the language model. That's why these days, especially in the developer stack, there's so much buzz and interest around vector databases, right? And that's why there's so many vector database companies, because they've basically positioned themselves as like a core data storage provider in the emerging LLM stack.
It's so interesting, right? We have this thing called the Salesforce metadata layer, where admins traditionally have put in descriptions for the benefit of other humans in that organization. We're finding now that it's very useful as an input for the copilot and et cetera. And then also trying to use LLMs themselves to generate even more metadata.
Another thing there that we've seen is interest in using like a semantic layer. So just like kind of giving up on the raw SQL and adding a simpler semantic layer to act on some simpler kind of like columns and insights.
Right, to generate a glossary for every company. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you were saying, Jerry, what are some techniques? And I mean, obviously there's not a one size fits all to rag on unstructured data, because there's so many different types of unstructured data. But what are some learnings that you could share with our audience?
Yeah, we've done a few talks on this. So for like very deep technical content, especially if you're a listener, you're a developer, just feel free to dig through some of our past presentations. I think maybe just articulate some of the high level challenges. One of the things about building like, you know, any of these workflows over LLMs, including RAG, is that you're basically building this overall software system, which becomes this overall like ML system over this like core module, right? Which is, of course, the LLM. And the main thing is that when you build this overall software system, the LLM itself is trained over data, but you're tacking on all these additional things like an embedding model, like your prompt, like the chunk size, your vector database choice, like the retrieval algorithm, all these different things. And they basically end up all just becoming hyperparameters. And the thing about regular machine learning is that you can optimize the model through something like backpropagation, through ROHF. Like there's like ML research, like, you know, gradient descent algorithms to actually improve the performance of your overall system. But especially if you're a software engineer or you're an AI engineer these days, and you're kind of like cobbling things together, one thing to note is that every time you cobble an additional component onto your overall workflow, it adds more parameters to your system. And so that adds more parameters you basically need to track, potentially manually tune, and also evaluate. And I think that at a high level sums up like some of the challenges with RAG right now is there's just a lot of components, even in a very basic RAG flow, for developers to set up and for them to do well. And so that's where you start getting into this like evaluation and iteration loop, where you want to measure metrics, go back, like tune your chunk size, tune your retrieval algorithm, tune all your prompt templates that you stitch together, and then basically finally decide that it's at a bar that where you can actually deploy it to production.
Of all the parameters that you just described in the RAG pipeline to fine tune, where should people start if they just wanted to keep it simple?
Yeah, I think what I would start with is basically first, just manually create a data set of like 20 questions or like 20 inputs that you think are representative of like something basic that you would want to test out. And then we have this entire like set of materials where we basically recommend starting small and then starting off like with the most basic stuff and then trying progressively more interesting and advanced techniques. And so especially if you're just trying to build a simple RAG pipeline, I think like inherently, you're not trying to build some like fancy agent. You're just trying to build some like overall thing that answers questions. And so there's plenty of like table stakes things you can tune. Like your chunk size is like a table stakes thing to tune, I think. Generally, for like your retrieval algorithm, there's like a best practice around like hybrid search, as well as a best parameter value for that. Tune your prompt template a little bit just to make sure that it works well. And that's like the simplest thing to start. You're not going to get too much delta, but at least you're going to improve beyond the baseline. Once that's actually not enough, once you're more ambitious with your goals, you want to ask like an overall broad research question and have this overall thing like figure stuff out. You want to like, you know, chain together like 10 different steps, and you want it to actually achieve all these things in a sequence, not only like give you back information, but also like send an email or like schedule a calendar invite or those types of things. Then you start needing to attack on like more layers of abstraction, like some sort of agentic reasoning layer, some aspect of tool use. And then I typically recommend like try to doing the simpler thing first, and then like adding some of the other components on top, just so that you don't like overwhelm yourself with complexity.
And that's what we're seeing as well. I mean, we've got our Einstein Copilot, but most companies aren't starting there. They're starting with turnkey use cases. We have something called Prompt Builder where they can embed those within the Salesforce experience. The most popular one is service reply recommendations if you're a customer support rep. But I think that's really good advice. Harrison, what about you? What trends are you seeing from your developer community?
I think we're seeing a few things. One's maybe a lot more interesting, kind of like few shot examples. We're starting to see that pop up. I think we're starting to see it pop up because a lot of the newer models do have longer context windows and are a lot faster. So with Claude's new HiQ model, for example, I think it's pretty feasible to stuff 5 to 10 few shot examples in there and still get a reasonable response in a reasonable amount of time. So I would say we're seeing more interest in that. I think most of the people that we're working with are still really early on in their journey, and so probably don't have kind of like the setup that Arvin has at Perplexity for fine tuning a lot of these models. I think they're just earlier on and still exploring. I think another trend that we're seeing, another term that I'll throw out there that I think I've seen on Twitter recently is flow engineering. And I think this speaks to what both of them are kind of talking about, this idea of chaining things together and thinking about what the flow of kind of like your application should be. And that's oftentimes because when you really try to go from a basic prototype to a more realistic production thing, it's not just like the prompt that needs improving. Maybe you need to bring in external context, or you want to break it down into sub problems. And so this type of like flow engineering we see rise in popularity.
And it's a nice way to bring kind of some determinism into the non-determinism, because you can flow out the steps in a very clear, predictable way.
Yeah, one way that I like to phrase it actually is I think one of the things that LLMs currently struggle with is like longer term planning and reasoning abilities. And so one way to think about flow engineering is you're actually removing some of the burden of planning from the LLM onto the engineer who's setting up the flow in some way. And they're imparting their kind of like domain knowledge of what the flow should be or what the plan should be. And so you're just making it easier for them.
I have a question actually. How do you think about the difference between flow engineering and like, I guess just like traditional programming? What's like the difference between like like writing Python and then just like setting up a flow?
Yeah, it's very similar. I think I'll do a webinar with Itamar from Codeium. And so he was the first one I heard use this term flow engineering. And that was actually one of the questions I wanted to ask him. And they wrote a great paper that everyone should check out. It's on like Alpha Codeium, or achieved kind of like state-of-the-art performance. And that was the first time I heard flow engineering. But yeah, it's really, yeah, it's just kind of like data engineering. You're thinking about your product, application development. I think maybe like, yeah, I think maybe an interesting twist would be this isn't really from a technical perspective, but to the point around like trying to think about planning, there's a lot of like almost psychology that's kind of in it. You're like, okay, if I'm a human, like what information do I need and how would I break this down? And like if you as a human couldn't answer the problem based on the information that you have, you know, then an LLM's not going to do it.
Certainly, exactly. And that actually dovetails to a different question I was going to ask, which is from the other side. I mean, most developers prior to this year have not been necessarily using AI. And going forward, there's this almost expectation now that we can use GitHub, Copilots, other Copilots. We have Apex, GPT at Salesforce, both to help with the code creation and test creation, but also increasingly, instead of writing and manually coding every software control flow, which are the parts of the code we can actually start to farm out to AI instead? How are you thinking about that, and how can developers prepare if they haven't had a background in AI and ML?
I did a survey among our engineers, like who's actually using GitHub Copilot and who's not, and like majority of them don't like using it. And
really?
Interesting. Tell us more.
Look, I was surprised too, but it's almost like these are all like really talented top engineers. So I think actually I was talking to this, you know, very popular or notorious, as if some people may want to call it, programmer, George Hotz, about this. And he told me that he doesn't actually want an autocomplete. What he wants is to have the AI tell him where he's going wrong and debug things for him. He wants things that are more like MyPy, like linters, debuggers, that are even smarter than what humans have written manually with a lot of heuristic rules.
That's super interesting because I think people call it generative AI, but in many cases, we see this outside of coding too, in sales and service, where the AI is actually even more powerful for analyzing than it is for generating.
Yeah, exactly. So these are reasoning engines, right? They don't always just have to generate completions for you. You don't always have to just go ask a question to a chatbot. Once it becomes part of your workflow every single day, like you don't even use it because it's AI. You just use it a much superior workflow that it's faster to get work done for you every single day versus the earlier way of doing things. Like currently, when you're writing code on GitHub, let's say you're pressing tab, you get a completion, you don't know if it's correct. You have some question, you go back to ChatGPT or you ask a question there and come back. And like, this is not optimal, right? Like, you need some better design workflow for this. So you
in the flow of work.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But I still think there's a lot more work to be done here to work backwards from the developer. What do they really want? And in some sense, it's almost like interactive AI. Like you just have to figure out the sweet spot of interaction here.
And do you think that applies to just the notorious developers, or do you think in general that's the case?
Actually, a lot of people would like things that just make life easier for them in terms of burden of like debugging and like figuring out new things very fast. I don't know, like whenever I coded, debugging has always taken the most time for me.
Yeah, nobody likes it.
But you have to do it, and you need to build a muscle for it, obviously. But you need to make things a lot more efficient for the next generation of developers. And right now, I feel like right now the way people debug is they just copy-paste the whole error and go to ChatGPT and ask, like, what do I do, right? But I think that step is inefficient. Like, something even better designed that's natively in the editor would be a lot better.
What are your thoughts on how developers need to change?
I mean, I'm going to be taking a slightly different direction, but I just say I think a lot of what Arvind said goes for non-developer products as well. Like, I think the UX around all these Gen AI applications is one of the main interesting things still to figure out and still to be worked on. I think, yeah, having it in the flow of whatever work you're doing and figuring out that UX is super interesting to me. And unfortunately, you know, I don't get to work on that as much as I would like to. But
I feel like there's going to be, I mean, we're building developer tools, but like, honestly, just taking a step back, like, I feel like there needs to be courses on how to just use AI, like for just a regular person, just use like ChatGPT or Claude, or if you're like picking up programming GitHub Copilot. It's such a big efficiency gain when you actually know how to use it. Just the other day, I copied and pasted an entire sales transcript into Claude. I don't know how public this should be, but anyways, basically, like, it's actually really helpful at summarizing like action items, and it saved me legitimately like 5 to 10 minutes, like going through this thing and synthesizing the insights.
Yeah, and so for developers and non-developers, how do we drive this awareness and education?
Like, yeah, I think there should just be, like, honestly, I mean, everyone should just use ChatGPT, Claude, Perplexity from, like, just a user angle, I think.
Einstein,
of course.
Yeah.
And there should be, like, courses, basically. Like, you know how back in the day, there were, like, you know, teach people how to use computers?
Yeah.
And especially when you're a kid, like, you know, growing up in elementary school, I had, like, computer lab. There should be, like, AI lab.
I mean, I agree. And, yeah, this will go a long way. A lot of people don't use AI. Like, it's still, we are still in a bubble here. Like all these productivity gains that we're all talking about, it's still a bubble. And like most people in the United States and many other, you know, high GDP countries don't use AI every day.
It's true. I mean, I was in DC a few weeks ago, and it's so hard to reform K-12 education because it happens state by state. But it's like, imagine growing up not knowing any of this, both how to use it, but also what hallucinations are, what the downside risks are.
Yeah. And a lot of it has to do with also the fear-mongering, and also that people use it for, like, wrong purposes, like cheating on homeworks. And so people are, in general, negative about, like, AI adoption.
Yeah.
Whereas, like, the reality is, like, hey, like, you can actually have a lot more time for yourself.
Well, imagine it's like if you were in the late 90s and you're like, there's all these cybersecurity risks, we shouldn't use the internet.
Yeah.
And that's ridiculous, right? But that's the equivalent of what we hear today.
Yeah, that's a good analogy.
Yeah. Well, one just shout out, and we would love your ideas and participation. We have a free online learning platform at Salesforce called Trailhead. And since last summer when we launched about 30 different AI courses, we've had over 1 million badges and certifications in AI.
Wow.
And so we would love your ideas on what other courses we should be adding just to help with the cause. So I know we're almost out of time, but I want to close just by asking, I mean, this is such a unique point in time. Here we are sitting in almost the middle of 2024. We've come such a very long way since ChatGPT was launched. If we fast forward 12 months, what are each of your predictions on the state of the art in AI and your companies? What vision and plans and aspirations do you have?
Yeah, for the broad AI, I think there will be even more capable models than what we have today. That's guaranteed for sure. I feel like there will be a new GPT that can do even better reasoning, even more long context coherence and things like that. And that'll help us build, like, make whatever's already there much more reliable. As for our own Perplexity, I think, like, we just want to get to the sweetest spot of accuracy and speed, which is very hard, by the way. Like, you can solve the accuracy problem by just having the largest model, but that is not going to be fast, not going to make for a great UX, and also not going to be affordable to serve to, like, many millions of people every day. So we want to keep improving there, and also, like, go beyond the generative user experience where it's just creating an answer for you. We want the answers to be specifically formatted for specific kind of queries. We want the interactions to be very different for different types of queries. Like, if you're actually asking for trip planning, like, it should be more interactive and not just generative. So we want to work more on that. And we also want to work on things like, what do you do after you get the answer? Like, why is it just lying around there in your fast threads? Like, how do you convert that into something that you can actually use? And that'll be very useful for people who use the product at work. So we're going to think more around the product layer.
Well, congratulations on your launch, the business segment. Look forward to seeing how that takes off. Harrison?
Yeah, I think on the model layer, agree on, like, the planning ability of LLMs. I think that's probably what I'm most excited about. And I think that'll be the biggest step change. I also think there'll be a bunch of models that are maybe at the caliber of GPT 3.5 that are super fast. And I think, like, Haiku has kind of opened up a lot of possibilities with these really fast models. And so I think that speed, especially as you're doing more steps, is really important. So I think there'll be a bunch of models there.
We'll use different size models for different tasks.
I think so. Yeah, absolutely. I think there'll be a tier of really good kind of, like, reasoning planning models, and you might use those when you really need to. But then I think there'll absolutely be a lot of, like, async background jobs that get done by faster, cheaper models. For LangChain, I think testing and evaluation is going to be a huge pain point as more things go in production, and you basically just want to know, is the application performing like I want it to perform? And so we're pushing a bunch on that. I think flow engineering will continue to get kind of, like, more and more complicated and important. And so I think thinking about what the right UX there is. This isn't so much LangChain, but again, UX for all these types of applications. Like, I think the dev and software engineering UX had some really interesting things with, like, the ability to rewind in the agent's trajectory and edit it. I think that rewind and edit, we're super excited about that. We're building that into a lot of kind of, like, the things we're working on. And then another thing at the app layer that I'm really excited for is, like, personalization. So I think right now, oftentimes, you know, I think ChatGPT added this concept of, like, memory, but it's still a little bit
rudimentary.
Is a good word. Yeah. And so I'm excited to see the boundaries getting more and more pushed on that.
That's something we're investing in heavily too, right? Both personalization in terms of who's the user and what's the history of what they've done,
exactly.
But then also who are they talking to? If it's a salesperson or service person, personalizing to that customer. Very exciting. Jerry?
I'm excited about just, like, general data representations and how, like, more data can be used with LLMs. This includes multimodal data, so video data, image data, audio, text. I mean, even beyond just, like, you know, just standard documents, there's, like, a ton of just, like, random unstructured data, both on the internet and also, like, within an organization. And so just, like, how do you basically tap into all of that and basically create the right, like, data pipelines and data infrastructure to make that accessible via models. And, like, all these models are getting natively multimodal, right? Like, I think all the Claude models are multimodal. They're going to be, like, right now they're kind of, like, text plus, like, you know, image in and then text out. They're probably going to natively, hopefully, be something like some combination of, like, GPT-5 plus Sora, right? Like, image in, text in, like, image out, video out, text out, like, that type of stuff. I'm really excited about that. I think from our side, you know, we launched an enterprise platform called Llama Cloud a few months ago, and it's designed to be, like, an overall managed platform for ingestion and parsing. And we want to build that out to basically scale up to more volumes of data, similar to what I talked about, but also just generally speaking, being able to actually process all this data, serve as, like, a key context augmentation layer for any sort of app you want to build, RAG, agents, or anything else.
So one question I always like to ask our guests is what they think about the future of education. And so for all the parents and caretakers out there, how should they think about how to guide children to succeed in this next era of AI?
So I like to think about it in the context of Perplexity itself, which is, so Perplexity is like an open book exam kind of person. Like it always looks at the web and then uses it to answer the question. So in general, like when I was in like school or college, I always enjoyed writing open book exams, right? Because I had a great memory power. I could always top the close book exams, but there were people who I considered were like smarter than me, but they were not being the top rank because I just had better memory power. And I always wanted to challenge myself against them in open book exams where this would not be an advantage for me. And whenever I used to beat them, I used to feel even better than just succeeding in a normal way. So I think that's what parents should encourage kids to be like. Don't try to be the best memorized reader. What happens when you are given all the facts all the time and still answering questions that would require higher order reasoning?
So just like for the models, you'd tell parents to focus on fine-tuning their kids' ability to reason.
Skills, reasoning. Yeah.
And leave the memory and exactly. RAG to the AI.
Yeah, that's why I mean, that's kind of how calculators are used. Like, you don't have to be really good at Abacus anymore. Like, you just use your calculator. But what you do with the calculations, like, for example, there are all sorts of interesting questions, right? Like, how many eggs would it take to fill up a room? Like, you can use a calculator for this to actually arrive at the answer, but the individual steps of, like, what's the size of an egg, like, how to stack them up, and, like, what's the square feet of the room? Like, these are stuff that's primarily with reasoning. You can find all the relevant fill-in-the-blanks from the internet or tools.
Harrison?
I'd probably just encourage them to get their kids to play around with generative AI in some form. I think it's still just, like, so early, and everyone's still figuring out what it's good at, what it's bad at. And so I think the more interactions that you can have and the more you get a sense for that early on will probably be helpful down the line, no matter how it ends up kind of like working into the day-to-day.
Jerry?
Yeah, I mean, I think I agree with all the above points. I think the only real risk of this is that, like, look, Claude is probably smarter than I am, in most things.
That would be saying a lot.
And they're going to get better. They're going to get way smarter than I am, like, in a few years. And so I think the only, like, risk is you just let your, like, kids or you yourself, like, depend entirely on AI without... I do fundamentally believe that humans should be able to reason about things and reason critically about things. And so to whatever way you can use that AI to basically complement that skill set and augment it so you're staying on top of the latest tech, but you're also still able to reason versus just, like, completely letting AI automate everything, I would encourage more of the former.
Yeah, kind of like you could use a graphing calculator, but you understand the underlying, calculus you're putting in.
I mean, to counter his point, like, even if Claude is smarter than you at certain things, Claude plus you should always be smarter than Claude. Like, that's what you should work towards, right? And I would also tell the next generation.
But you'd have to be smart enough to leverage Claude fully.
Yeah, that's up to you. And, like, that's where, like, you know, his point makes a lot of, like, sense, which is, always keep tinkering and learning and try to use these tools in very creative ways that, you know, even the developers of them might not have considered. Because that's what I feel like is the difference between, like, what OpenAI did and Google did. Google was training all these large models before OpenAI, but OpenAI tinkered more with them and figured out that prompt engineering actually works. And therefore doubled down on training large language models versus bidirectional models. Like viewed them beyond just fine-tuning tools. So,
it's the empirical, it's the tinkering, not just the theoretical.
Yeah, tinker a lot, try to see, like, how you can build new things that were just not possible before at all.
And then after OpenAI released some of the models, a lot of the really cool stuff was happening on Twitter by random people with access to the APIs. And
right.
Like, yeah, that's the state of this technology.
Yeah, as Jensen said, like, the next generation of programmers will be writing a lot of code in just natural language. Like, which is like the flow engineering part. You're still architecting things. Mm-hmm. You're still controlling how things will work sequentially. Okay. But you don't have to go and write, like, hardcore code anymore.
Mm-hmm. Very exciting. Thank you for all that each of you is doing to further the industry and to inspire so many of us. And look forward to seeing where you take your company next.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Arvind, Jerry, Harrison, thank you so much for being with us and for your insights. Three takeaways for me. One, LLMs need tooling around them to make them work. Each of these entrepreneurs is doing that, as is Einstein and Data Cloud. Two, there's a need for both developers and non-developers to reskill and really learn how to use generative AI. And third, there's a great debate around when to use retrieval or RAG and when to fine-tune models. For most companies, most of the time, you can just get started with RAG, which is a part of Data Cloud. That's all for this week on the Ask More of AI podcast. Follow us wherever you get your podcasts and follow me on LinkedIn and Twitter. To learn more about Salesforce AI, join our Ask More of AI newsletter on LinkedIn. Thank you and see you next time.